Well, when I say, and I sometimes do, get the best of the best on this radio show, and by the way, good morning, Steve Dale's Pet World on WGN, this is the best of the best. He travels all around the world teaching veterinary professionals, and he's one of the nicest guys I know, Dr. Michael Lappin, also one of the tallest men I know, from the University of Colorado College of Veterinary Medicine, Professor Internal Medicine. Good morning, Dr. Lappin.
Well, good morning, Mr. Dale. It's so great to hear your voice, and I'm honored to get to be part of the show, and you're so complimentary.
Oh, don't think you get away. You owe me $5 now. But really, I'm telling the truth, and anyone in veterinary medicine knows that's the case. I can't think of many that are more well-respected than you. And for all that you have done and continue to do for cats, including hosting Colorado State University with the Every Cat Health Foundation, a symposium about feline infectious peritonitis, or FIP, September 6th and 7th, that, okay, you're thinking, well, I don't live anywhere near Colorado State University, but you can attend online. I'll tell you about all of that in a couple of minutes. Why is this important that we talk about feline infectious peritonitis, or I should back up and say, what is feline infectious peritonitis?
Yeah, that's a good place to start. It is, in the past, the worst feline infectious disease, something that they could catch, right? Infectious. And that virus, until the last 7 years or so, it was uniformly fatal. It was a horrifying disease. And why we're so excited to talk about it now and to spread the word is we have, with funding through the profession, not just at Colorado State, but multi-institutional around the world, we're now saving between 85 and 90% of these cats, and we want to spread the word so that everybody knows this is no longer a universally fatal disease. We can save these cats.
And it's something people now know about because FIP, which is the short way of saying feline infectious peritonitis, is really created or caused by a mutation of something called the coronavirus. And that is something that we now, since COVID-19 is caused by a coronavirus, that people are, unfortunately, all too familiar with.
Yes, exactly right. It's distantly related to that darn COVID virus. But it's amazing that a lot of what we learned, I mean, if there's any silver lining to COVID, is some of the things we learned with drugs for COVID, we can actually apply to saving cats with this other coronavirus.
And that is happening now. So you mentioned 85 to 90% of the cats are, I forget the word you used, it might have been saved, but are they actually cured? I mean, do we know that FIP, we know it's no longer fatal, but and we know it's now treatable. Are they treated for life?
Yeah. You know, the great news is the majority of them go into remission with a success rate of around 85, 90%. And then most of them stay in remission. And so we hope that we've actually cured the body of the virus, at least in a proportion of the cats, within another small group having recurrence of their syndrome or their disease. But, you know, even the ones that recur, we now have options for them as well. So overall, I believe we probably are curing some cats. Some cats with recurrence are probably getting reinfected, or maybe we didn't get every virus out of their body. But we're still having some pretty great success rates, even for that small fraction that come out of remission. So it's so exciting time for feline medicine. It's just been amazing.
Well, you're part of that story, but that story goes way back. That story goes back for decades, and a professor at University of California, Davis, Dr. Niels Petersen, among many all over the world, who really but Dr. Petersen was devoted and determined to find a way to first understand FIP, because this turns out to be a somewhat confusing virus to even for veterinarians to even completely understand what was going on with these cats in the first place, Dr. Lappin.
Oh, exactly, Steve. It's been really, really amazing. I've been hanging around with cats as a veterinarian for about 40 years now, and I was really fortunate to be a young veterinarian while people like Niels Petersen and Fred Scott at Cornell, for those of you in the Northeast, they were just coming up with great ideas and trying to sort out how to diagnose this viral infection as well as treatments that we've started talking about a little bit today. And they were just instrumental. In fact, Steve, you'd be interested. I actually was just in Cornell lecturing on the weekend in the Fred Scott Feline Symposium, one of these great FIP researchers. This was the 37th year of them lecturing about cat diseases because of one of these famous FIP researchers, Dr. Fred Scott, who we lost earlier this year. But yes, we have made progress in diagnostics, how to actually prove they have the infection. We are learning more about why some cats get sick and others don't. And even more importantly, we're saving them now.
Yeah, that's the most important thing of all. And FIP for you must have been the most, and I'm glad I can say that in past tense, must have been the most heartbreaking diagnosis to make to a pet parent, because most of these cats are in fact kittens that get FIP.
Exactly. You know, it's kind of, we've always talked about it kind of being a biphasic, with most of them being really young and then some of the older cats breaking with the disease later. But it was heartbreaking. You just get your new kitten, and all of a sudden it comes in with a fever and off its food. A lot of them get fluid in their belly and in their chest, and then it's hard to breathe. They lose weight. And then, gosh, when we could make the diagnosis, it was then knowing that our treatments were likely going to fail. And so it was a really emotional fatiguing for the veterinarian as well as the owners, because we knew that the end was coming.
And I want to talk about that veterinarian side of that story when we come back, and also talk about the symposium and how you can attend this event, which is for all of you who happen to love cats, on September 6th and 7th. And we'll do that when we come back with Dr. Michael Lappin on WGN. Dr. Mike Lappin is, I think, Dr. Cat in America at this very moment, having done so much. And we'll talk about some of these other things beyond FIP. He is at Colorado State University College of Veterinary Medicine in Fort Collins. But you can be anywhere, literally on the planet, and attend this symposium, Dr. Lappin, that we're doing right in your backyard. I'll be there. But this goes beyond that because of something called the internet. So people can watch anywhere they happen to be. Simply go to everycat.org to learn more about it. Some of the speakers, in fact, all the speakers that you have, Dr. Lappin, will talk about sort of, I don't know, this is the way I'm putting it. I'll hear about the way you put it in a moment, sort of the practical side of all this. For cat lovers to better understand what they can do about it if your cat is diagnosed, or what the signs are in the first place for a cat to be diagnosed, and also what the future is regarding FIP. I'll let you say it in your words, however.
Oh, I'd be happy to, Steve. It's going to be an amazing symposium. Thanks again to EveryCat for hosting these symposia over the years. We're proud to get to host this year. But it's going to be amazing because we've designed a program that is interesting, we believe, to people that might be scientists studying the virus itself, clinicians that are learning how to diagnose and treat it better than we used to, and even of interest to pet parents that either have owned a cat in the past with FIP and would like to learn more about how we can save the next one. And so it's just going to be a great 2 days, honestly. And those of you that can come, Colorado in September is pretty fantastic. But if you can't make it this time, the facility that we use, the Translational Medicine Institute, I'm actually in that building right this second. Surprisingly, Steve, I'm actually not on the road. It is amazing, and I'm looking at Horsetooth Rock on the Colorado Rockies foothills, and about 40 miles behind it is Long's Peak at 14,000 feet. And so if you come in, go to the symposium, hang around for a little bit, it's kind of a fun place to be.
Indeed. And I know you are very, very, you really should work for that. In retirement, not that you're ready for that, I've got the perfect job for you. You could work for the State Department of Commerce or Tourism or something, because you absolutely love Colorado, but you feel that same way about Colorado State University. The other thing is, if you do attend in person, which you can do, there'll be a reception. You get to meet all of the speakers, ask questions of those speakers, all of that if you attend in person. But it's easy enough to attend online. Again, every Cat Health Foundation, that is the nonprofit organization responsible. I think Dr. Lappin, for what is it, about 60 years now, for about everything we know about cats, in one way or the other, there's no organization that exists like it on the planet, which is to fund cat health studies, that's all, and to educate pet parents and veterinary professionals following those studies. And I know you're a fan of this organization. I'm on the board of the organization. So everycat.org to learn more about this important event. Can I talk about you for a moment?
Sure.
I believe, I heard a rumor that you have an allergy, and it happens to be to cats?
Isn't that crazy? A person that loves cats, maintains 5 cats as my friends at the house, and loves to work with cats at my job, happens to have low-grade cat allergies. Yeah, if I let the cat sleep in the bed, which I know we're not supposed to, but if I let the cat sleep in the bed, I wake up a little bit congested, a little bit itchy eyes, and I think I'm allergic to that salivary protein they make, that one they call FLD1. I think I'm one of the lucky ones that has a cat allergy, even though I'm cat crazy.
Well, and of course, you're not alone. It's one of the most common allergies on the planet. Now, people think they're allergic to the hair, and the longer the hair, the more there's going to be a cat allergy. And as you point out, that's not at all what people are allergic to.
Exactly, yes. This protein, FLD1, that's in a number of secretions, but particularly in the saliva, it's a really sticky protein. And so when they're grooming, it sticks to their hair. And so when their hair comes out, just routine normal shedding, then that allergen can spread throughout the house, and then you can get exposed to that allergen. And allergen, by the way, depends on allergic type reactions in this case. It might have sneezing, coughing, runny eyes, sometimes itchiness. Yeah, it's just right there in their saliva, and we now know every cat has it.
Yeah, every cat, not the nonprofit organization, but every cat has this, has FLD1. So there's good news here that is remarkable. So there I am. I don't know if you know Dr. Patricia McConnell. She is incredible. She wrote, among her many books, The Other End of the Leash. She is primarily known for dog behavior and dog training. She is like the goat of dog training, and she loves cats too. And she told me on this very radio show, she said, I can't have a cat, I'm allergic. And I said, whoa, wait a minute, but you can indeed have a cat. And she said, well, but I'll suffer if I have a cat. And you know what? The what we're going to talk about after the break, Dr. Lapp, and I would suggest if more people knew about this, fewer cats would be relinquished to shelters and more cats would be adopted from shelters. This is, to me, one of the greatest scientific breakthroughs, and it's really for – it's in a cat food, but it's really for us, Dr. Lappin, as for the cats, because I think so many cats would be saved. It's just a matter of getting the word out, and we'll talk about what it is that I'm talking about when we come back with Dr. Michael Lappin on WGN. Dr. Cynthia Otto has done so much in her career, and she's the recipient of the 2025 American Veterinary Medical Association Career Achievement in Canine Research Award. I'm a small part of that story because when a friend, Darlene Arden, who wrote about pets and broadcast as well, passed away of ovarian cancer in 2017, she directed money being spent as a part of her legacy to train dogs at Dr. Otto's University of Pennsylvania's Working Dog Center to detect ovarian cancer. Now, ovarian cancer oftentimes, and this is the problem, there are no signs, no symptoms. People don't know until it's just about too late. It's diagnosed late in the game. And so far, medical science hasn't been able to figure out a way to help at least many, if not most, of those women at that point. However, things may now change because of Darlene Arden, because of an ovarian cancer nonprofit organization, and because, greatly, of Dr. Cynthia Otto's University of Pennsylvania's Working Dog Center. Because indeed, she did train dogs without a problem to detect ovarian cancer. Now, she had to prove she could do this. Science is like that. Prove it? No. Prove it again and again. And she did, and she did. And once it was proven that dogs could detect the chemical markers, now what happens? Well, she got chemists and others involved who said, aha, and this is the point we're at now, apparently, that we can figure out a test, a diagnostic test, to detect ovarian cancer earlier, much earlier. If that indeed happens, and it looks like it may well happen, can you imagine how many lives will be saved? Countless lives. And not only ovarian cancer. Dr. Otto told me, if we could do this for ovarian cancer, then let's look at stomach cancer. And let's look at other kinds of cancers where there is no diagnostic test, of which there are sadly too many cancers that have no diagnostic test. This is just incredible, right? And that's only a part of what Dr. Otto has done at her Working Dog Center. I'll name two other things. One is COVID-19. She trained dogs. She's the one in America, anyway, who trained dogs, or her Working Dog Center did, to detect COVID-19, which during the pandemic was helpful. Now in Pennsylvania, there are these invasive lantern flies. How can they be found? Well, she's trained dogs to find them. Congratulations to Dr. Cynthia Otto and Darlene Arden. Professor at Colorado State University, Dr. Michael Lappin, is all things cats, has done so much for cats. This, I would suggest you agree, you're not responsible for this, although it would have been cool if you were. But how brilliant to come up with this idea. So people who are allergic to cats, and we're talking about what I have read anyway, is the most common allergy in the U.S., being allergic to cats. Now you don't need to be anymore. Well, you might still be allergic, but the impact won't be as, it won't be as impactful. You won't suffer those same symptoms. What the heck am I talking about, Dr. Lappin?
Yeah, that's such a great lead-in, Steve. It's, gosh, all we could do in the old days was take drugs to block the reactions or not own cats. You know, we vacuum like crazy because there are other things that we're allergic to. But to have a cat food that would make you less reactive to your cat is just earth-shattering, honestly. It's the first diet of this type, perfectly great diet for cats, but the diet is actually to help you as the cat owner. It's amazing.
Yeah, it is. And it's called Live Clear, Purina Pro Plan, Live Clear. And it's a complete and balanced diet, as you point out, for cats. It's a Purina Pro Plan diet. Of course it is. However, this diet, you won't be, if you give the diet to your cat, the cat food's not for you, it's for your cat, and give the diet to your cat, then how is it, what happens that I won't sneeze or my nose won't run and have all those reactions that people have? Or if I have it, it won't be nearly as bad.
Yeah, it's a really brilliant idea. Evernature over at Purina, this brilliant immunologist, he had the idea that if you made antibodies that could neutralize that salivary allergen, that FLD1, those antibodies could potentially be put on the cat food. And so when they're eating the cat food, the antibodies that neutralize the allergen is going around in their mouth, right? Because it's on the food. And it actually inactivates a proportion of their FLD1. So they don't quit producing FLD1, but that FLD1 is inactivated by the antibody that was coated on the cat food right before it was put in the bag. And so basically you can lessen your reaction to your cat by feeding a cat food, which is just crazy cool because, again, that you have to eat anyway, right? And so cats just eating cat food just like it normally would, happy as a clam, doing great, growing and all the good things. And then you would potentially have your allergy signs decrease.
Do you agree that what I said before the break, that if more people knew about this cat food, and over time they will, but we're talking about then fewer cats being given up to shelters because allergies are a significant reason why people give up their cats to shelters, at least that's what they say. And also the reverse, that more cats would be adopted from shelters as well.
Oh, Steve, because you're active in this field, obviously even more active than I am. And how many times have you heard people say, I can't have a cat because somebody in the family is allergic? It's a daily thing for a behavioral interested person like you, a cat veterinarian like me. And there are plenty of surveys of shelter cats, why they were relinquished. And one that pops into my mind quickly was about 18% of the cats that were in that shelter were perfectly healthy. There was nothing wrong with the cat, but the owners thought they were allergic to it. And so you're right. Cat allergies is a great way to get relinquished. A family member with a cat allergy is a great way for you as a cat to get relinquished. And to be able to lessen that is going to save lives, right?
Yeah, and I would argue also save you medical bills as a person because you won't need to see that allergist as often, if at all, and won't need as many drugs, if any. And that is a good thing, I think, Dr. Lappin, too.
Yep, I agree. You and I are on the same page on that one, Steve.
Yeah, so it's called Purina Pro Plan Live Clear. Now, I want to talk about H5N1. First of all, for those, just as a reminder, what is H5N1 and how does that potentially impact cats?
Yeah, that's a great one, too. That's a really important virus right now around the world. In the United States, you've probably heard about it killing wild birds, and then you may have heard about it jumping into flocks of chickens and backyard chickens, as well as poultry operations. And then this one actually made it into the dairy cattle, and it's coming out from their milk. And then all of a sudden, we started recognizing more cats with severe neurological disease, sometimes following a mild respiratory break of like sneezing, maybe a little bit of difficult breathing. And so it's a influenza virus that generally prefers birds. So it's an avian influenza virus. But that group can jump around a little bit. And now this one's jumped in, like I said, from wild birds into domestic birds into cats, cattle. And there's now been 70 people also have been infected, most of them being poultry workers where they're getting a big dose of the virus rather than cat owners and lovers. But it is pretty scary when you have a virus that'll do more than one species, in this case, birds, people, cattle, and cats.
I have a couple questions about that. So why is it that cats are more susceptible to bird flu, which is what we're talking about, to be clear, compared to dogs?
Yeah, that's a really great question, Steve. And to not get too technical, all viruses get into cells, you know, the cells of your body, like your lung cells and your brain cells. They get into the body via receptors. And different species have different affinity, or they have receptors that like viruses, different viruses better than, say, another one. And so it just so happens that cats are one of those species that, even though it's an avian influenza, cats have a lot of those receptors. And, you know, we just saw that with SARS as well. If you guys remember, cats and people have similar receptors, letting the SARS COVID-19 virus into their bodies as well. So cats were just unlucky enough to have the right receptors for this particular strains of the virus that are circulating right now in the United States.
The name of her most recent book, or one of them, Brooke Shields, is Not Allowed to Get Old. And Brooke, a pleasure to talk to you. And I feel that you now feel the same way about our pets.
I absolutely feel almost even stronger about our pets because, especially in this era of my life, my kids are all gone to college. I have a different, more, even more personal relationship with my pet. And we lost our Pepper a couple of years ago, and it was such a devastating thing for all of us. And I hadn't been that aware of if there had been anything I could have done better. And beyond the guilt, I'm not talking just about that, but we don't often think of our pets as we do our own health. And they deserve it just as much. And I believe that a lot of what is environmental, or what we're feeding them, what we're putting on them, ages them exponentially. And when I became aware of Prospect Pet and how they started on the farm and how they were, you know, clean and conscious and ethically, you know, sourced. And it's just, I really started thinking, okay, I have to change. I've done so much work on being healthy myself. I need to focus on my pet.
So what are you doing as far as making that change? And by the way, let me ask like seven questions at once. So I apologize in front for that. But at the same time, here's what we know. We know our pets are living longer than ever before, but that's on one hand. On the other, we have a subset that is significant that is actually succumbing, dying sooner than they need to be. The Golden Retriever study has shown us, and the reason why we're doing that study in the first place with the Morris Animal Foundation is because it has been noted that that's the case. And a lot of what impacts our health in the environment, which you mentioned, we know for dogs for sure, and to a degree with cats as well, impacts their health. Can you comment on all of that?
All of that. Well, here's what I mean. The environment piece is also begins with what environment you provide for your pet, right? So not thinking globally, not just, but what is missing in your pet's diet? What can aid your pet? So yes, pets are, some are living longer and they're also seeing a higher, higher cancer rates.
Yeah.
So what is that? What are we doing? What are we giving them? And, you know, what do we not know? And, you know, I come from the 70s where you were just like, oh, it was kibble and just throw, you know, kibble in the bowl and they'll eat it. And it doesn't really matter what brand or anything. And we just don't think of it because we think, oh, they're animals, they're dogs. And as I've grown up, I've learned that things like joint mobility is important and flexibility and comfort for your dog. You know, why does the dog limp when it goes down the stairs too fast? Or, you know, what am I not doing for my pet? So I think that my comment is, I think we have to keep learning. And what we have to do and what Prospect has to do is keep educating people, because that's, education is power. And we've learned so much about, well, I mean, it goes back and forth, but what we put in our bodies, what we shouldn't put in our bodies, what we should put in our bodies. And we're so sort of obsessed with that. But it's really, really important that we look at our animals as we would our own health. I mean, yes, they are animals, but they are also beings. And whether, you know, I never thought of putting paw protector on my dog until she started running at the beach. And now she'd come back and she'd be licking her paws and I looked at them and they'd be raw. Hmm. So, you know, Prospect had paw protector is something that I never thought. And, you know, I worried that if she licked it off, it would be unsafe. And it's perfectly safe. I didn't know that, you know, I've heard salmon was good or pumpkin was good, but I didn't know, I never thought about how it was sourced. You know, the skin and coat, how the product has, you know, wild Alaskan salmon. You know, you don't really think, you think, oh, I'm giving them fish or I'm doing this, but we need to take the understanding and education a little bit farther, and we can provide that to people. And once they learn it, because these pets are our children. And once you learn that, and once you sort of say, oh, I don't want to do anything harmful to my own self or my pet, I think that we will see, hopefully, both of those stats continue to be improved.
You have been a longtime advocate for mental health. Do you think that pets can play a role in helping our own mental health and the reverse as well, that we can play a role in supporting theirs?
I think both of those things are so incredibly true. I mean, you just look at, you know, my younger daughter, when she was little, she split her head open. And while she was in the hospital, terrified and, you know, getting 14 stitches and stuff. And they said, you know, could we bring this support dog by? And I knew she loved dogs and she was only like 6, 7. And she was even younger. And this dog came by and just put her little head on the bed. And I swear there was like a glimmer of a smile in my daughter. And she had been so terrified, and it wasn't anything her mother could give her or whatever, but there was just this little connection between the two of them. So I've gone through some terrible health issues, and my first dog would just sit at my feet and come up and lick my face and then go sit at my feet. And the support and the calm support and unconditional love that our pets give us is so important and irreplaceable. And I've noticed my dog is so in tune to my mood. And if I'm stomping around and I'm anxious and I'm giving off energy, her ears go back a little. She kind of follows me differently. And when I'm joyous and happy, she kind of just plays with whatever she wants to, or, you know, or she'll just flop at my feet. You know, there's a different, she's vigilant differently when my mood is put out there.
When she's stomping around, Brooke Shields stomps around, apparently.
I stomp sometimes.
She stomps.
I'm a stomper.
Yeah,
because I've got so much to do. I have to stomp to get to the...
You know, it's been said that it's very difficult for some actors to work with animals. I know some actors who say, you know what? That's not the case. Lucille Ball told me, as long as there's the laugh, and I'm going to make sure there's the laugh, and if the animal, if the dog or a cat typically, but with her it was a wide variety of animals over the years, doesn't hit its mark, for example, then I'm going to make sure that animal is there on its mark. How do you feel about working with animals?
I immediately go to the trainer and I say, give me as much as you can and let me spend every break with the dog. Mm. And I want the dog to know me, or the cat. I was doing Pretty Baby. I was 11. And there's this amazing scene where this kitten comes up and I put down a glass of milk, and the kitten just walked over to the milk and kept licking it out of the glass. And then I just sort of stayed in character. And then after the cat was finished, I just grabbed the cup and drank it. And it's like one of my favorite scenes in the movie. And I just recently had to work with a dog, and I get very, very in tune to the dog. And I make sure that the dog knows that what it's supposed to do, but feels like really confident with me. I have no problem working with dogs, animals, or I had to work with these alpacas in a movie. And they were like, have you ever worked with alpacas before? You're really good at it. And I was like, worked at the San Diego Zoo when I was a kid. I mean, I just went and birthed baby lambs. I have such a hands-on, they sense your confidence. And so I make sure I work really hard to make the dogs that I've worked with look good, or the alpacas.
Well, that was one lucky dog, or lucky alpacas. Brooke Shields, what a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you very, very much. I appreciate your time.
Let's face it, as mere humans, sometimes we get moody. But we're not alone. Dogs and cats, same thing. That should not be a surprise. After all, they are emotional beings. But the University of Lincoln has now noted in research that the same is true for at least one species, and likely many others, of tortoises, the red-footed tortoise. It turns out they have emotions and moods and use spatial and cognitive judgment just like we do. Can you believe that? Well, this can change everything about how we perceive reptiles as pets and how they're kept in captivity in zoos and such. It turns out the study concluded that reptiles are capable of experiencing a far wider affective spectrum than previously considered, a finding that is critical in regards to how we view reptiles. We'll talk to you next week, bright and early, on WGN.